think that you needed to be brought up to date on development, relevant development here. You know that Guyana and the United States have just reactivated the 19-year-old ship rider agreement. It is going to be reactivated from next Monday. And I'm seeing a report here saying that it is not going to be used by the U.S. This is what the president of Guyana is claiming, that it is not going to be used by the United States to conduct covert operations against Venezuela through Guyana's territory under the guise of anti-narcotics operations. And he was speaking to the media shortly, exchanging notes for the activation of the 19-year-old shipwrighter agreement from next Monday. So there are many people who are looking at the relationship that is evolving between the United States and Guyana and looking to see to what extent the new administration is going to use its relationship with the Trump administration in the United States to actually become a staging post for intervention in Venezuela. Others are looking at it from the point of view of the fact that Guyana has now found all of this oil and that the United States wants to get closer to Guyana as a result of that. So we have these interesting developments. You may recall that years ago Barbados said no to this very shipwrighter agreement. This is down to brass tacks. Hello?
A blessed day to you, Mr. Ellis, and to your guests.
Yes, sir.
And I wish a beautiful weekend for not only you and your guests, but for the entire country as well. Mr. Ellis, this program is so much in demand that don't mind how long you have to wait. You are so stimulated that you will wait. And I think this is a mark achievement for our station and very much interested for the entire country and the wider Caribbean as well, because it shows that this station do cater to the wider Caribbean and to our nation as well. And I want to really give the station and all of its the moderators high compliment for this as well, you know? Now, Ms. Ellis?
Yes, sir.
This is not my main thing I want to speak about, but when I heard the news speak just now about Secretary of State or somebody leaving Guyana and a short while ago, and when you just said what you read there, that it's happening, you know, sometimes it makes you sometimes say the things that you ought not to say. But to be allow ourselves to be used in any way by the United States, who violate their own laws, you got a president who are doing these things, nobody can say nothing. And then they will want to come to encourage us or those who would bow to them to do what they want, because they're now looking to get an invasion from outside of the United States next door. I mean, Mr. Ellis, I don't know how some of us think of ourselves to be used in these ways. Yeah,
you're dealing with politics, and you're dealing also with issues of economic development. And what we don't know is what is the United States promising Guyana in exchange for the support that Guyana is giving to the United States. We are sitting down here talking, for instance, about putting all of the eggs in any one basket. Guyana, while it has discovered all of this oil, you know, there's a risk it takes if it puts so much emphasis on that to the exclusion of other sectors of the economy. And I've heard in some quarters that even before the elections that they were eyeing significant investment in other areas. So we have to wait and see what else is in the bag in this regard.
So you would sell your very soul.
Sell your soul? Would what constitutes selling your soul?
Or if you are going to give up any kind of sovereignty like this in this way,
Let me hear Dr. Christina Hines on this aspect of it. Surrender of sovereignty. How do you believe that sovereignty has been surrendered? By the shipwriter agreement?
But you're right.
I would say so, to some degree. To me, it is a very troubling development, because this region is supposed to be a zone of peace. I've heard people say, many analysts talk about the region being a zone of peace. And this really can inflame certain tensions. I can understand the insecurity that people in Guyana feel because there is a level of militarization of certain border areas between Guyana and Venezuela, and the Venezuelan army is certainly more impressive, if let's put it that way, when compared to that of Guyana. So there is that threat. And if you think about it in terms of what we would call a realist perspective, balance of power, they're aligning with a more powerful entity that can help them. But in terms of peace and stability in this entire region, just for Guyana, I think this opens us up to some instability and insecurity that the absence of this shipwriter would have shielded us from. And even in the OAS, Organization of American States, there is this rift across Caribbean states as to whether the current government, the Maduro government in Venezuela, should be recognized or not. So I'm very uncomfortable with this, not just for Guyana, more so for the rest of us who may feel some of the consequences of this move.
I mean, Ms. Elliott,
yeah?
When you recognize how they came down with a shipwriter, that they give themselves the right to want to come into your country to extradite and to hold somebody and go along with them, and yet, still, if you are trying any money belong to them, they're saying to you, you can't try their citizens, you have to let them do that. Wouldn't nobody in Guyana, the leadership, see what they are now trying to create in the Caribbean? Look, I'm telling you, I am really upset about it, really. And if we choose not to see, and there's none so blind as he who just will not see, and this is what we are now encountering here. I am worried about it, I'll tell you. And I believe that CARICOM should know. I believe Ms. Motley still is is she still the chairman of CARICOM? Or
no, she isn't.
No.
One of them.
And I'll tell you this. For me, I would like to encourage the chairman of CARICOM to have a meeting in CARICOM, because this is troubling, And I'll tell you this. We've now got to wonder what is in the document that Guyana has gone and signed on to. I'm serious about this, and I'm troubled.
In 1997, Jamaica and the United States signed the shipwriter agreement.
This is serious, and I'm really troubled. Now, the next thing...
I think the difference with this one is the Venezuela element, though.
Okay.
Because although Jamaica signed it so that it's really Jamaica that is ending up being policed, but in this instance, I think bringing in Venezuela and the very contentious relationship between Venezuela and the United States of America, and also a somewhat contentious relationship between Venezuela and Guyana, this makes this very dangerous, potentially.
Yes,
and I think that CARICOM should intervene to make some kind of statement or clarify the nature of this relationship.
But to what extent is Guyana influenced in siding with the United States on the basis of the fear it has coming out of the territorial dispute with Venezuela?
Mm-hmm.
To what extent is it protecting its own interests by going in this direction? That's another dimension to it.
Yeah, but
this is an important point, because we should remember that foreign policy is conducted based on self-interest, nation self-interest. It's usually cloaked in a lot of fancy terms and so on, but it really boils down to the national interests of the countries involved. And you're right, Guyana has security interests with respect, also economic interests, because there's been some disputes, territorial disputes, and also as it relates to the territorial waters, in which case some of the oil findings are implicated. So there's no, certainly it appears to me from a distance that Guyana may be acting also in their interests, where the U.S. may be promising some security guarantees.
But we also have to act in ours. So these things can't be viewed in isolation. So whilst Guyana may be taking a particular approach to try and secure itself, which I don't know that is necessarily the best way, we also have to think what the implications of this will be for the wider Caribbean and for us. And if this may, in fact, pose some insecurities for the rest of us in the region, the other states, the other residents of the region, we also have to think about our self-interest and use the mechanisms that we have to at least raise this issue with Guyana. What are y'all doing? Why are you doing this? Can you guarantee that we are going to remain safe in this arrangement that you've made with the USA?
Well, Barbados in 1997 signed a controversial treaty with the United States to stem drug trafficking throughout the Caribbean. This is what I see here. But Barbadian officials said that the pact is different from the Shipwrights Accord, which many other of its neighbors had signed as well. So Barbados took its decision to sign its own agreement with the United States. The question is, to what extent was Guyana in a position to question Barbados's decision? And in that context, therefore, how does Barbados move to this point of raising this issue unless the only difference is the fact that Venezuela is involved?
The major difference, okay. Not the only difference, because when it came to other Shipwrights agreements, there were not other countries that were armed and able to pursue some kind of military attack in response. This was about the U.S. policing us. In this case, this is not so much about the U.S. policing Guyana. It is about the U.S. using Guyana as a launch pad to police Venezuela. And not even, I think this is the guise of narcotics. I don't feel narcotics is the real issue. This is, to some, if I can speak freely, this is about regime change. Because there is contention, the United States of America is supporting a leader of Venezuela that is different from the one which we have been told otherwise is the leader of Venezuela. So Guyana is involving itself in something that is very risky, which is fine for Guyana to decide as a sovereign state. But the rest of the states in the region and perhaps even the hemisphere need to consider what the implications are for us, because we don't want to end up now in some kind of zone of conflict. So I think we can say something, and states say things about
in all fairness, I think we have been involved in this zone of conflict. Barbados, not so long ago, facilitated meetings between the Maduro faction and the Juan Guaido faction in trying to find a solution to the problem in Venezuela. The difference is, as you are saying, you perceive that this relationship with the United States now is of a military nature, and that they wanted a launching pad for their military action. But somebody else also says here, the Americans want a place to set up, and they also want to be there because the Chinese have been moving into Guyana, and the Guyana government, they say, and the Guyanese government are so blind. But all you have to do is to show the politicians the greenbacks, and they will do anything. Then others say this has a lot to do with the elections. Guyana got their payment when the U.S. insisted on regime change in Guyana. If you say that, then you're also implying, Dr. Hines, that regional governments who were critical of what was happening in Guyana at the elections were siding with the United States, and that the courts in the Caribbean, and Guyana in particular, and at the CCJ level, we're in on the plot. I mean, there's a lot, there's so much to discuss on this one. Perhaps another day we will have to to have a fuller discussion on this. But let's get some calls.
I think so.
Down to brass tacks. Hello?
Yes, hello?
Yes, welcome.
Yes, I was speaking with you.
Yes, before, ma'am.
And right, I got disconnected.
Sorry about that.
Where had I put it? Yourself, Dr. Hines, and also the doctor, the economist from Canada. And I was cut off.
You were cut off? Nobody yes, cut you off. Off. You dropped out.
Yeah, well, you probably are dropped out.
You're right.
Correct. Due respect. Mm-hmm. But the doctor from the economist was going to make a statement as to what I was saying pertaining about the $300 million going into the revenue for the hotel industry, which we can, I don't want to be pessimistic or anything, which we know is going to be difficult because we can see the cases are rising back up in the UK where our bulk of revenue is coming from. The US is horrendous. My question to all of you is, suppose though nothing happens there, what do? We take $300 billion to throw into a tourism industry, and then there are people out there who are still suffering.
Oh, I think the caller probably missed
a lot of discussion that took place already.
Yeah,
we've covered that to a great degree. You know, there are diverging perspectives on it. The degree to which we put money into tourism in a COVID period, where it's difficult to see how we are going to be able to recover in the environment that you just spoke about, versus what else are we going to put this money into? And is there anything else that is as competitive as the tourism sector to deal with the immediate problem of 40,000 job losses? So that's the dilemma that we face. And naturally, you know, you have different views on how we proceed on this path. And the critical thing that has emerged from the discussion today is that it is all well and good to hear these plans and ideas, but we all know that the difficulty lies in implementation and the details and the extent to which, when do you start to roll it out, who gets what, and how people position themselves to be able to get a larger share than the rest, and ultimately, are you using this opportunity to bring about a change in the power relationships that exist? Coming back to this shipwrighter matter, on April 12, 2001, there was this story that said it took more than 4 hours of intense pressure from the United States, but Guyana has now joined 23 other countries in the region in signing an agreement that allows U.S. officials to chase suspected drug smugglers into their national waters and airspace. Guyana had been a significant holdout in the region, worried that the U.S. Drug Enforcement Agency, or DEA officials, would willy-nilly enter national territory without gaining the necessary permission and without a local shipwrighter or law enforcement official on hand to make any arrests. But Cabinet and Defense Secretary Roger Luncheon said after the Maritime Law Enforcement or Shipwrighter Agreement was signed this week that issue had been resolved. He said approval would not be necessary in the case of emergencies. So this shipwrighter agreement is being reactivated because it had been in place for quite some time before. It'd be interesting to get the background as to what happened that it actually went into a state where they now have to come back and reassert that it exists. This is Down to Brass Tacks. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ellis.
Yes, sir.
And to your guest, Ms. Hines.
Yes. And we have Carlos Fort as well.
And Mr. Fort from Canada?
Yes.
Well, I could say this, Mr. Ellis. You know I'm on vacation from Brass Tacks.
I thought it was long leave, actually.
Well, you could call it what you want. But today, I enjoy this program so much. I break it for a couple minutes because I'll be back on vacation after the show. Miss Sainz.
Yes.
Is she there?
Yes, she is.
I'm here.
Miss Sainz, you're doing a fantastic job.
Thank you.
I will let you listen back to what you put out there just now dealing with the issue with America and Ghana. You can say it better. I give you 9 out of 10 for what you said just now. It has me in my 70s scared. And I say, and I don't know how they have anything to see that is a frightening thing. After the election, coming right after the election, it say a lot. But let me get
you
to
should
where
be,
we're
you going. Should be particularly frightened that it is also coming with the Trump administration in Washington. Because there are those who are saying that in their judgment, he needs a distraction. And, you know, America's policies have been such over the years that when a president runs into trouble domestically, he looks for some external warfare as a means of trying to bolster his domestic situation. But nothing like a war.
I understand you, Mr. Ms. Ellis. But where I am concerned, always follow politics. Mr. Trump ain't in trouble losing next election.
Okay.
If
so
in trouble,
so you don't anticipate that he will use Venezuela as basis for any military action?
I don't think he's in that. The Black Lives Matter made Trump strong. That is my belief. But okay. That's a different story for another day.
Mm-hmm.
That the choice that the Democrats made in America can't beat Trump. But I will leave that for another time. Miss Ellis, I was so annoyed on Tuesday. That I don't think you know how vexed I is.
You think I worry?
I know you don't got worried. Because everything's be an alibi and a going wrong and trying
but
to
what were you so vexed about?
They take my lady, a lady that I think 98% of Barbados love, and put her on a political platform. And
Is that any different from, I think you're referring to the throne speech by the Governor General, and the way that the speech is written when she's asked to say my government and that sort of thing?
I ain't only talking about that.
What you talking even, about? Even the last years?
Listen, even if you could...
The last decade?
No. Let me tell you. Don't tell me.
I won't hear.
Even if you could Passad, the things that she say, I heard that from him already about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
And?
I am saying you should not use my lady or any other governor general or even the president that expect to come in that way. For 2.5 hours. 60 pages of what? Huh? I heard the gentleman there, Mr. Ford, and I got a lot of respect for him. I live in Canada, but I like certain people, like he and the signs in my good book.
No, but we understand what you're saying. By a process of elimination, you know who it.
Let me tell you something. I heard the Prime Minister around March, April, no, it can't be April, because she was on sick leave then. Before her sick leave, which was on the 22nd of March, giving Barbados the impression about all this big work can start and $1 billion can spend. Miss Ellis?
Yes. I'm listening to you.
We have a speech. New talk again. And the media that I keep complaining about.
Oh, my goodness. You can go now.
Years.
Look at trouble now.
Listen to me. I care for things. You're across Mr. Ford right there. So you can't cross me. I have no call.
You can't tell me what to do. You think you can give me instructions? I tell you, when you want to give me instructions, you talk to me off the air. You're coming on the air to give me the instructions?
I heard our Prime Minister. And she came out in the...
I don't understand what your complaint is.
When I get in there, that was written by our Prime Minister. I tell you, I listened to her for years.
Is that any different from any throne speech that is written, that has been delivered in the country before in that context?
Mr. Ellis, I'm willing you. I never hear one. So
okay, well, I can take you back to 2013, 2008. This one was delivered by the then Governor General. It begins, "My government comes to this hallowed place at this critical juncture in the history of this nation." My government. It's no different. They all are...
You're talking about my government. That is the problem with it.
What's your problem? They are all written like that.
All government generals, they say my government. I'm not dealing with that part.
Okay.
I am saying that the Prime Minister Barbados know that she has the oppressed. That don't question her. What she say and what her party say.
Honestly...
There was a law in March to tell us what they're going to do and what to expect. Ain't do nothing. And could come out in this again to give you more promises and the press ain't gonna ask one question. After today, you hearing goalkeepers or gatekeepers, because most of the moderators now is yes people.
Look, let's cut to the chase here.
I'm telling you,
no, you're telling me. Listen to me. I tell you already. You're not running
me.
No. You. I'm not giving you just another platform to launch into the press and into the calling program and stuff. That's what every time you call, anytime you slip down in there, Alvin, you're wasting time with us. You really, and you're wasting the time with the people who listen. I'll say to you, his point is that you can't expect to hear in a throne speech anything that was said previously. But throne speeches have traditionally restated government's position. The same 2008 throne speech said that my government is philosophically committed to ensuring that every Barbadian resident has access to comfortable shelter. You believe that was the first time that was being said? It will therefore over time remove VAT from building materials and houses valued up to $400,000. And it goes on and it goes on. I do not understand the point. All right? If I had to say anything about your throne speech, I really believe that we have reached the stage. I don't know how my other colleagues here on the panel feel. But I feel that we've reached the stage where the throne speech does not need to be that long. I mean, we should perhaps be able to get highlights of it, 60 pages, and to put the Governor General in a position where she's stumbling through this speech, because chances are she might not have had enough time to look through it or something like that. I mean, that is not fair. That is not reasonable. And the listeners are not going to sit down and listen to no throne speech for 60 pages, or with two hours or something like that.
Well, I guess perhaps that is going to be the last throne speech. But the point that you're making is that a lot
you
of
you mean the president speeches, the president didn't admit one.
A lot of these speeches
it'll
are
call something else.
A lot of these speeches recently have been too long. It kind of started near the tail end of the Oinata administration with some of the budget speeches, the current prime minister's speeches are very long. Let me just put it that way. Even the budget speeches, the mini budget speech, for example, even though it was called a mini budget, was too long. And even avid people that have avid interests, both from the economic side or the political side, like Dr. Hines, it's hard to really engage and stay tuned in these speeches. I really think they should be a lot shorter. A throne speech, I believe, should be a lot more high level with the thematic framework of the government's policy and not going straight to a lot of detail. But even, again, as it relates to the budgets, I think they're too long. Here in Canada, the budget is the size of a book. So you can't really present the budget in its entirety. And the speech that is presented to Parliament is like 2 pages or something like that. What they do, though, is that before the presentation of the speech, they have what is called a lockdown with the press. And the press is essentially briefed on the key components of the document. And that allows for the dissemination of the essence of the document. And I think we probably need to change our approach where that is concerned.
I tend to support that. I feel that if we are serious about this issue, of bringing about change. The government of the day needs to set the example by start wasting so much time. Why do you waste all of this time in the speech and other speeches? Why do you waste time in so many other areas? I can tell you, I've talked about it before, ministers of government go to assignments and they waste so much time. They don't set the example. It is as if you have been put in a special position to make people believe that you are important by how long you keep them waiting. And when I used to be out in the field as a reporter years ago, sometimes they turned up and they didn't even apologize for keeping you waiting, because that was supposed to be their right. My view is that it is in these little things that we actually try to recalibrate how Barbados does its business. And if we can't get those things right, then we are wasting our time when we encourage other people to do the very thing that we don't practice. So I think that looking at the amount of time wasted in the speeches and stuff is an important issue, because in addition to everything, you lose too many people. They're not interested, and then they depend upon the press to precede and paraphrase what has been said so that they can at a glance see what the highlights are. I don't know whether Dr. Hines has a view on that.
Yes, I do. It makes me think of a word that my grandmother used to use, pompousetting.
Yes.
So I think there is a lot of that we end up seeing. Some ceremony and pageantry is nice. I would love to see more of it that is, as I've said in other places, indigenized, that reflects us and not a whole set of colonial legacy. But generally, people's attention span, we have been told, is around 20 minutes. So when you get into the realm of 2 hours plus, you are really asking people for a lot. 2 hours without a break. So, you know, when you're teaching, for instance, they tell you things like change activities, get people to do different things to keep them paying attention. Something like a throne speech, you are asking people a lot to stay tuned and stay logged in for this period of time. And certainly you're asking the Governor General, or if when it's the President, you're asking that person to do a lot to do this that is unnecessary, because then we still end up reading the highlights. So give us the highlights and then provide us with the depth later. And even in all of this 2.5 hours, we still don't have the details. So you could as well as have given us the highlights anyway, and then give us the details in some other setting.
Yes. Down to brass tacks. Hello. It's 1:45. Wow. Just another 13 minutes or so to go in this program. Hello. Who's up next?
This is Mohammed Nasser.
Yes, sir.
How are you?
I am okay.
Oh, good. I got a couple of things. Too much time on what's going on, so I don't. No, we were talking, and you and your guests, and let me say a good afternoon to your guests. And besides, I'm very proud of you, because you have an outstanding father and one of the best there is in Barbados when it comes to a human being is Dave Hines, your father.
Yes.
No, that is the truth. If you know this brother, you know he don't pull punches. If it was the other way, I'd say it too. That man is an outstanding man and a generous and kind man to people in this country. But this is what I want to find out. Is it not time we talk about all this money the government putting into tourism, to save tourism and things like that? Is it not time we really analyze and accept? Because I hear a businessman said yesterday that business is a partnership between workers and management. I certain that's what I hear he said yesterday. Is it not time that with this crisis we have now, there are people in all kind of problems, that we accept that as soon as these tourists, if God bless this country, tourism to turn around, God is all we have apparently for now, that those people that want to still be home, the people are going to set up new systems to make more money, they will never pay back the money that the government...
What is your recommendation?
My recommendation is that it's time that we sit down now with the workers and decide to let the workers become shareholders in these businesses that they have to rebuild. because all the business got to be rebuilt. And I do not believe that the workers should be rebuilding any business.
The government has been speaking about, for instance, redeveloping the BADMC or some aspect of the sugar industry.
Mm-hmm.
And haven't you heard a recommendation that will go in that direction? That's one thing that I can recall.
That's only talk, dog, alone. But the $300 million is really reality. But the other one is
only
talk.
That's a public-private partnership, though.
Yes, it's
really
a public-private partnership. Yeah,
but we want it not with the government alone. We want it with... In other words, if my workers in trouble now and I have to use them now to rebuild my company, there should be some partnership in the company that they're rebuilding. That's the point I'm making. Not only in Barbados, but throughout the world.
Okay, let me get some reaction from the panelists, given the time that we've got.
Carlos? Want me to start?
Okay, well, either of you. A brief response to this idea of worker participation, which we've heard about so many years.
Ownership.
But that's the same thing. Ownership and participation. That's what
I don't think government can mandate it, except for where government is providing financial infusions or subsidizing or what have you. Government can tie that to providing employee share ownership. There are some companies. Williams Industries, for example, they provide employee shares to their employees. So government can do that.
We serious look at what Williams Industries do and let the public know what they do, so you'll discover that it's not as simple as you know say.
Okay. Christina?
I think it's a useful idea. I believe that it would take a certain type of business that is willing to do this, because a lot of business entities are not willing to do that. You know, the profits are for the owners, and the workers are to come to work and do as people say. So I think it takes a shift in mentality. I don't know how you can mandate this as well. I think this has to come from business owners, and perhaps a relationship between business owners and their employees. So I think there needs to be a shift within the culture across the private sector to make this possible. And I don't know how you can get that shift. It is on individual businesses to make this decision for themselves, but it may offer them some gains in terms of the engagement of their employees in their businesses, their commitment to ensuring that the businesses succeed. So I do see benefits to it, but I just wonder whether in this country that we live in, how much of this will be taken on by anybody who owns a business.
Let me say that this idea has been mooted for a long time. There are companies in Barbados and elsewhere in the region that have employed it. What we need more than anything else right now is an assessment of how it has worked. You know, we have enough examples of companies where the people who work in the companies have been able to invest in shares and that sort of thing. But does that by itself make the difference? And this is where perhaps the University of the West Indies could become useful, more useful. I mean, there are, you have various departments there, and in particular
management studies
and stuff, to see. And I suspect that work has been done already. I doubt that has not been touched. It is a question of perhaps sharing with the public to a greater extent what these findings have been over the years. But from where I sit, I don't believe that share ownership alone matters, because there are people in the country who are workers in businesses and those who are not, who buy into companies and still have absolutely no say whatsoever in what happens in the companies. They don't feel as though they are a part of that. You know, they see all sorts of maneuverings that are engaged in to try to minimize the extent to which people who are minority shareholders will never be able to influence what is going on. So
that comes down to corporate governance, though, because to me, if you are And I'm not an expert in management studies or business, but when we're thinking of governance and you have stakeholders, you should really be engaging your stakeholders. And especially if you have two roles now, as both an employee and a shareholder, your commitment to the company, one assumes, may be enhanced because you have a stake in it, but also your voice should be heard. This doesn't always mean that you will get what you want, but you should be able to have some input. So in theory, it sounds like something that is feasible, but we have to think about how businesses function as well. If you have a family-owned business, you may be thinking about your family and not including other people that work there in the shareholding of your enterprise. So I agree, Mr. Ellis, there certainly is a lot more work that needs to be done on this. I believe there is work done on it already in order to inform us to the about the extent to which this is beneficial or can be beneficial.
We can't even get a vibrant stock market in this country. The government says it can establish a junior stock exchange to encourage and promote investment in Barbados's businesses, give micro and small businesses an alternative source of financing through equity financing while expanding entrepreneurship, employment, and economic development. The big question is, why is it that the senior stock exchange has failed? It's all part and parcel of this.
But what's the benefit of listing most businesses in Barbados? So this may also be that for this small place that we're living in, many businesses do not see listing on the stock market and being publicly traded as beneficial.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. And to tell me that if in general this is where we're failing, and that if we move in the direction of more worker participation, that it is going to be stronger and better. I don't know. I think we need to understand what has caused the problem in Barbados. I think many of us know that already, but we need some empirical evidence to support it. This is down to brass tacks. Hello? We got 4 or 5 minutes, so let's talk. I don't think that it's going to be feasible to take another call at this time. So let me hear your view.
I think the market is, well, the market is too small. I think we probably should be looking more at the idea of a regional stock market. But
Texas.
Well, and therefore, maybe when we speak about listing companies and shares or what have you, we probably forget about the Barbados stock market in that insular sense and encourage companies to list on the regional stock markets or one of the existing bigger stock markets within the region.
Long recommended too. Nothing really seems to happen there.
But it comes down to, I think, legislation. So harmonization in terms of regulatory framework, financial regulatory framework, also in terms of corporate governance. So one of the things you mentioned just now, for example, is that the implication there is that there's a need for better protection for minority shareholder rights that exists in large capital markets, minority protections. And I did do my thesis on dividend policy. And one of the key findings there was that where there are strong minority interest protections, companies tend to pay higher dividends or pay dividends, because that's the other thing. You can have shares, but there are no dividends being paid. And then there's the question of, if you want to sell those shares, can you sell them? It really only has value if there's a market for it. But they would be a need for legislation that fosters that type of thing, almost by requirement. Many years ago, I had suggested to the, I think it was an economic consultation, where they were talking about stock market development. And I said, one of the issues is that there are no requirements for publicly listed companies to provide quarterly financial reporting, for example. Mm-hmm. And markets trade on information. So if you have the annual reporting, for example, and I think the discussion then was that a lot of the shares are undervalued. They're undervalued because there isn't enough activity, there isn't enough reporting, and there isn't a sufficiently strong corporate governance and regulatory framework that lends itself to activity on the markets. But again,
Justin Robinson studies this too, you know. Professor Justin Robinson at UWE, he also has done quite a lot of work on regional stock exchanges and so on. So there is information out there pertaining to the region. I don't think there is any evidence to indicate that in any time soon we are going to see a lot of vibrancy in this, in these stock exchanges, though.
And the underlying issue is confidence in the market in that regard. And there's been quite a lot of erosion. And here, in an environment where we've been discussing about private sector-led growth, we still have to depend so heavily on governmental action to be able to try to facilitate that kind of change. And at some point, we have to examine too, I mean, how much private sector initiative are we actually seeing in Barbados? And to what extent, now that we have had COVID, have we taken one step forward and three steps backward because you have been forced to depend upon government stimulus? And the more that you depend upon government stimulus in this, or in this environment, to what extent does it really retard the progress towards private sector-led growth? I hope that we could come back sometime shortly and discuss this particular matter. But I want to thank you both for joining us. We began by having Dr. Christina Hines with us as a guest today, and then we were joined on the line from Canada by economist Carlos Fort. Thank you, Dennis Johnson. Thanks to all of you who participate in this program, either as callers or as listeners. I'm David Ellis. Do have a great afternoon and a very good weekend.